Welcome to Inner Circle, the premier softball podcast. Here are your hosts, Eric Lopez and Victor Anderson.
And welcome to another edition of In the Circle. I'm Eric Lopez alongside Victor Anderson.
Nice, I'm more calm now. Yeah, thank you. I was just about to say, it's nice to see you're in a more relaxed state after the mood you were in after we were reviewing Selection Sunday.
Yeah, it was a little fiery. I got a little emotional, a little fiery.
A little fiery.
We encourage you to check that out. We break down a lot of the regionals and the selection committee's incompetence on that. But coming up on this one, I'm really excited about this one. This is why I'm in a good mood.
Yes.
We'll be joined by Adam Schick, longtime Florida Gator voice of softball, and he's done other stuff, women's soccer, women's basketball. He's hosting the podcast on FloridaGators.com, and he's now the voice of the MLS franchise in Atlanta, and why that will affect some things, because this is it for Mr. Schick.
Yes.
As the voice of Florida softball since 2008, Mr. Anderson. 2008, yes. I met him at the regional in 08.
Did you start at UCF around that same time, too?
07 was my first year. 08 was my first regional that I covered for UCF as a play-by-play person. He was next door to me. So we'll talk a little bit about that, but also we'll talk about the Florida Gators, the number one overall seed, hosting this weekend in Gainesville. Can the Gators make it three national titles in 4 years? We'll talk to Adam about that and much more. But before we get to Adam, Vic, tell the audience where they can find us.
Follow us on Twitter at InTheCircleSB. We're closing in on 600 followers. We want to get to that before the Women's College World Series. Thank you again for your support. Of course, you can follow our blog, InTheCircleBlog.wordpress.com. Follow our podcast and subscribe to our podcast on Podomatic and Apple Podcasts. You can always send us an email, InTheCircleSB@gmail.com, and follow us on Facebook as well.
Should be a good one. Well, let's not take any more time. Joining us now, it's been the longtime radio voice of the Florida Gators softball program. He joined them in 2008. Coincidentally, the Gators run kind of started off to their first Women's College World Series that year. We know what they've done since, and he's got a chance to see it from the, no offense, Vic, the catbird seat.
None taken.
And, of course, I speak of Adam Schick. And joining us now is the longtime radio voice of the Florida Gators. He's been there since 2008. I still remember it. That was my first NCAA tournament.
Would we consider him a friend of the podcast?
That's a very accurate statement. A guy who I respect so much. I met him at the 2008 regional. I've shaken his hand many, many, many a times after a Florida win over UCF. Too many, I've lost track. I only know two times that I shook his hand when UCF beat Florida. That was simple to keep up. No, once, actually, because one of the wins was in a forced and if necessary game, and Florida won that game. So really only one time.
Yeah, pretty much.
But we're still friends, and that's my good friend Adam Schick joining us. Adam, how you doing?
I'm doing well, guys. Thank you for having me. Glad to be a friend of the pod. That's a pretty big accomplishment right there, to be a friend of any pod.
Hashtag FOP, friend of pod. We have many of them right here.
There you go. Well, just give me your reaction now. Everybody's talking about the selections and the brackets, and we'll get into the Florida side of the bracket with what happened as far as their potential super regional situation. But first, let's focus on Florida and the reaction, your reaction of their regional in Gainesville, where they got Oklahoma State, FIU, and FAMU as a number one overall seed.
Yeah, it was interesting. I mean, it was easy to immediately look at the super regional potential matchup and get lost in that. And I was driving, so I was listening to it, and I didn't even see the regional bracket until after the selection show was over, because I had no idea that Oklahoma State was a team they sent to Gainesville. Interesting enough, last year, Oklahoma State was in Georgia's regional. And there was, at that point, the talk about, well, what if Oklahoma State came out of that super, then came to Gainesville, and you had the matchup of Tim Walton and Kenny Gajewski, his former assistant, and one of his best friends in his entire life. So we had looked at that. Oklahoma State forced the if-necessary game against Georgia, but then lost in the if-necessary. Georgia came here, and the rest of that is history. But sometimes the selection committee, I feel like they try and create some interesting scenarios, and then if they're thwarted, they'll find a way to make it come back around. So if it wasn't going to happen in Supers, this year, they said, okay, we're going to do everything we can to ensure that this matchup happens and makes it interesting. And obviously, if Oklahoma State beats FIU, then it will happen. So it's a very interesting regional. It's not quite as tough as I thought it might be because there's no dominant ace coming here. If you had FAU, for example. So I think it's a very manageable regional for Florida on the field. The question is, what's the off-the-field dynamic, especially with Tim Walton, Kenny Gajewski knowing everything about each other and how they work?
And let's dive into that. Kenny was an assistant under Tim, helped build that national championship team. For people that don't follow Florida softball closely, tell us a little bit about Kenny Gajewski, that the Oklahoma State head coach, and the impact that he had on the Florida program and coaching under Tim Walton.
He had a huge impact on the Florida program, and I think there, to some degree, in the last couple of years, people may have not discounted but undersold just how important he was. At the time that he came in, 2013, Florida was really reeling in a lot of ways. There was the whole fiasco following the 2012 season when you had the players dismissed from the team. Florida ousted in its own regional. Really, the only huge blip on this 10-year run that we've talked about for the Gators. So he came in 2013 and really helped shepherd the program back to where it needed to be. If you look at what Florida did in that first year, they got back to the College World Series, reestablished that tradition, and then 2014-2015, back-to-back national championships. He left following the 2015 championship, was not around last year, and again last year, you could say it's because of one bad pitch to Kaylee Puuailoa, but either way, Florida did not make the College World Series last year. So I think if you look at his impact in the program, he had a really calming influence of sorts on Tim Walton. Before Kenny Gajewski came around, Tim Walton was very, very intense, and he's still intense, but he was much more lighthearted when he had Kenny Gajewski around to sort of bring that side out of him. So I think he was hugely important to the program and really getting Tim Walton to change direction on a few things within the program to help be more successful at that final stage and win national championships. So he knows a lot of what makes Coach Walton tick, and that's why I'm fascinated to see how that plays out this weekend.
The personnel, and I've made this comparison. You tell me if this is accurate, and it reminds me a little bit of the Tampa Bay Buccaneers when they won the Super Bowl with John Gruden. He was the head coach at Oakland. Got traded to the Buccaneers. They just so happened to play in the Super Bowl, and Gruden knew the personnel. He knew the tendencies of Oakland,
sure.
And they even showed it on NFL Films highlights where he was playing, impersonating Rich Gannon and doing the pump fake, and John Lynch was mic'd up.
Suggle scene.
Right, and John Lynch is like, we knew that play was coming. We knew it. Is there concern from a Florida perspective with Kenny knowing the personnel and knowing Tim's tendencies that Florida may, this is going to be a tricky situation because he knows that roster and he knows the personnel, he knows Tim's tendencies. Could we have maybe Florida having some problems here because the opponent knows you as well as anybody?
Yeah, it's possible. I wouldn't say it's likely, and here's why, because ultimately it comes down to your personnel as well. And looking at Oklahoma State, I haven't had a chance to see them play this year, but the first thing I did is looked at their pitching staff. They don't have an overpowering ace, a shutdown ace. The leading pitcher on their staff, Brandy Needham, has a 260 ERA. That shouldn't be a huge concern. Now, if they had a really impressive ace that was hot right now, that would be a concern because of the way Florida's offense has gone into some significant droughts, especially as of late, if you look at what they've done against top 25 competition in the last couple weeks. So I don't know that those tendencies are going to matter that much because I don't think Oklahoma State has the horses. Florida, in a must-win game, will have Kelly Barnhill in the circle, and there just aren't enough teams in the country that can hit Kelly Barnhill. So if you're a team like Oklahoma State that's got a pretty good offense but not great pitching, that's not the kind of team I think will threaten Florida.
And Adam, you mentioned Kelly Barnhill. Came on as a freshman last year, really – had her moments, her inconsistencies, but as a sophomore has been tremendous. And a lot of people feel she may have now taken over as the ace of the staff over Gourley. What have been your impressions of Barnhill from her freshman year to what she is right now as a sophomore?
I think what's most impressive is her maturity and her growth, just the way that she's been able to take over games. Last year, she had the stuff. It wasn't quite as electric as it's been this year, but you would see early on in games, she would come on and blow people away. But then the issue was the second, third time through the order, hitters made adjustments and she didn't. And she would get frustrated. She would start overthrowing, walking a lot of batters. and ultimately was bailed out of most situations and had to come out and was replaced. And then someone else would finish off the game, be it Gourley or Ocasio. This year, she has become an all-in-one. She can close her own game. She can close someone else's game. It's not just about a hot start. She can consistently baffle hitters from start to finish. The only real blip on the radar for that was what we saw against Florida State, and that was 11 innings of Barnhill against some of the best hitters in the country. At a point, something's going to give there, and you should see an adjustment. We saw that from Powers and from Warren with homers off of Kelly Barnhill to give Barnhill her first loss of the season. But I think if you look at Barnhill overall this year, she's shown a real ability to get herself through any situation and dominance that we've just never seen here at Florida.
Is she the player of the year?
I think so. I mean, if you look at the numbers she put up, you guys have to understand, she went undefeated in the SEC with an ERA of .09 in conference games. And, you know, Florida played Auburn, they played Tennessee. I mean, Florida played a lot of really, really good teams,
now that,
and she put up those kind of numbers.
Now, that's not .09. That's not .90. That's .09, friends.
And every time I say that, I have to make sure to say, no, I'm not talking about .90. That is .09. I'm not misspeaking here. That is less than a tenth. So that's what Barnhill has done this year in what has to be the toughest conference in the country. You can argue with decisions that the committee made, and I know that you guys have and will, but as far as the SEC goes, when you put every team in your conference in the NCAA tournament and you have a pitcher that put up those type of numbers, I don't see how you're not the player of the year nationally.
Yeah, I would agree with that. What do you think about Gourley and Ocasio? I mean, that's a deep rotation. Will Tim use all three throughout the postseason? Does he just ride Barnhill? I mean, that's what I'm fascinated about with Tim. Definitely Gourley being the lefty, I would think, will be in the mix. Ocasio has been more of a hitter as well as a pitcher. How do you see the pitching staff being used throughout the postseason?
Yeah, it's a good question. And I think a lot of people have wondered that lately, especially as Barnhill became the real ace of the staff. And toward the end of the year, Barnhill started throwing on Fridays and Sundays. Gourley would throw Saturday. Early on, Gourley was the game one starter. And then it just got to a point where Barnhill was so dominant, it was crazy not to have her throw two games, in a series if you could. So I think Gourley's definitely going to get her starts, and she'll have moments where she's called on. I don't know that Ocasio factors in the circle, just because, as you guys know, when you get into the postseason, you're talking about one, maybe two pitchers. And in the situation where you've got some innings to eat up, whether it's because you're down by a lot or you're up by a lot, then you maybe see Ocasio. For example, I think Ocasio could start against Florida A&M on Friday. That wouldn't surprise me at all. But Ocasio got a big opportunity against Tennessee in the final game of that series. And late in that one, she gave up a grand slam on an 0-2 pitch with two outs that cost Florida that game. Now, if you want to dial it back, and, you know, we do this externally a lot more, I'm sure, than players do and coaches do, but she also gave up the walk-off to Kaylee Puyiloa in the Super Regionals with two outs on an 0-2 pitch. So when you've got options like Kelly Barnhill, who's going to be, I think, the player of the year, and a senior All-American in Delaney Gourley, I just don't know if there's a spot for a number three like Ocasio, who struggled to close out games. I'm not sure where she fits in terms of big opportunities on the largest stages.
We mentioned the fact she's part of the offense hitting more this year. What's your thoughts on the Gators' offense 2017? They struggled down the stretch last year, and in particular in that Super Regional loss to Georgia. Your thoughts on the offense here? Do they have enough punch to get not only to Oklahoma City, but bring home a third national title?
Yeah, I think that's the biggest question, and no one has any questions about this pitching staff at this point. That is certainly set in stone what they're capable of doing and what they've done against the best competition. The offense is the real question mark, and Erica, it's just hard to know. I mean, I think what's maybe most telling is what we've seen in the last 2 weeks. Florida really struggled to get anything going at Florida State, and that's understandable. You have two of the better pitchers in the Southeast, in Burroughs and also Megan King. But then Florida couldn't get it going in the final game at Tennessee against Matty Moss, and then they didn't get anything going against Ole Miss. Now, you had a really, really hot pitcher in Caitlin Lee, and she showed that against multiple teams. But it was Florida's inability to really get anything going offensively that was most surprising. Not just a lack of scoring runs, but Florida couldn't even get on base. And that's really what they've done. They had two singles in that game, and those are the only base runners they had in the entire contest. So if you look at where Florida's at now, it's kind of hard to gauge, because if you break that up and you look at last weekend, that's what makes it really tricky, because Florida, in their final week of the regular season, they stepped out of conference play because they were already finished, and they played Florida A&M and North Texas, again, two teams that are not going to challenge the Gators, and they put up huge numbers, right? So there's a school of thought that says, well, you just need something to get the bats healthy, and then you can turn it around. But Florida had that get-well type weekend, and then it didn't translate in the SEC tournament against Caitlin Lee. So is that because Florida doesn't put a huge amount of importance on the SEC tournament? Is it because Caitlin Lee was having a moment? It's tough to decipher. What I do know is that Florida is really strong at the very top with Lorenz, with Kvistad, with DeWitt, in whatever order that they are put in. It's after that that you have a lot of questions. There's a lot of players with numbers this year that have been off of what you'd expect, not a lot of production in terms of power. I don't really know the answer, I guess, is the easiest way to say it. It's kind of a wait-and-see approach, but certainly I would say from a Florida perspective, there is some concern about the way the offense has looked going to the postseason, especially when you consider the way they looked going into last year's postseason and the eventual result.
Should Florida advance past the regional, they will be in the Super Regional hosting next weekend in what should be the marquee Super Regional of the series. And, Adam, what I find amusing is the way it's set up, Florida will either play one of their big longtime rivals in the conference in Alabama, similar to last year with Georgia, or they're going to be playing a Minnesota team that, shockingly to a lot of people, is not a national seed. That's 54-3. They have a Player of the Year finalist in their own right in pitcher Sarah Groenewegen, who's going to be probably the ace for the Canadian national team in the Summer Olympics in 2020. I thought the number one seeds usually got an easy draw.
Yeah, it seems that Florida is really the victim of the NCAA's decision to not seed Minnesota, because at that point, it makes sense, because what are you going to do? You're going to send the best unseeded team to the lowest seeded team. And then you could argue if Alabama belongs there, which if you look at the way that they finished, I think a lot of Bama people expected them to be a little bit higher in the 13-14 range. I always thought, to be honest with you, that this would happen. And by always, I mean about 3 weeks ago when I started looking at the RPI and who was in that area, especially after last year what we saw with the Florida-Georgia matchup, two teams that are traditional rivals that did not play in the regular season. Once I saw Alabama in that area, I thought this was a possibility. So I'm not surprised at all that it's potentially going to happen. But you know, it could also easily be Minnesota. And then you're looking at giving Florida a really tough matchup. That's the one seed facing a team that's in the top 10 of the country in a super regional. So either way, I don't think it's great.
You realize, depending on the polls, because the final poll before the tournament comes out this week, that if it's Florida and Minnesota, we could have the top two teams in the country in the polls facing off each other in the Super Regional.
Yeah, no, it's bonkers. It's Looney Tunes. And I think there's going to be a lot of debate about that going forward. Either way, the point I'm making for Florida is that I think it's very challenging, because I have not seen Groenewegen, but obviously I know her numbers and know her reputation. I have seen Sydney Littlejohn for Alabama. She is a pitcher that gives Florida fits, very similar to Chelsea Wilkinson with Georgia traditionally. And then look what Wilkinson did last year in the Supers, just dominated Florida on their way to the World Series. So there's door number one, door number two. Both doors present very, very difficult challenges for Florida's offense, who has struggled with consistency and against those types of pitchers.
It could also be the first time in the history of the Super Regionals, if Minnesota were to advance, you would have two teams over 50-plus wins, meaning in the Super Regional. And as I mentioned, there is a chance, because the polls, I think Florida was number one prior to at this recording, and Minnesota was like two or three in some certain polls. We could have the top two teams in the country playing in a Super Regional, which is insane. And that, I guess, give me your thoughts on that. That's the hottest story right now in college softball, the Minnesota people up in arms. What was your reaction? You mentioned you were in the car and you kind of Florida, your reaction when you heard that Alabama was paired up with Florida, but that Minnesota was also in the Alabama regional?
Yeah, to be honest with you, I think I was more focused on the Alabama angle just because I've been knee-deep in Florida, Alabama for so many years. It wasn't until after the fact when I really looked into it and read some of the outrage that I understood exactly what Minnesota had accomplished this year. It's very curious, and I heard their justification was they didn't have any top 10 wins, and everybody else who was a seeded team did. And I get that argument, but at the same time, it's also a product of your conference. And the Big Ten didn't have a particularly strong year, so that's why they didn't have as many opportunities to beat a top 10 team. So I think it's hard to look at their numbers and their resume and say they're not worthy of a top 16 seed in a regional. And I'm curious to see what kind of chip that puts on their shoulder, because Alabama looked pretty good when I saw them in the SEC tournament. Alexis Osorio looked really, really sharp, and obviously Sidney Littlejohn's a senior who's been around and has accomplished things at the highest level too. So I'm curious to see the chip on the shoulder of Minnesota. What will they take into Tuscaloosa? Will they come in feeling sorry for themselves and, you know, not at their best, or are they going to say, let's stick it to the committee and try and get all the way to Oklahoma City through this unfortunate path that we have? We'll see what response that they decide to do.
The flaw with that committee logic about, well, they haven't, you know, the top 10 teams and top 25, part of the problem is, for Minnesota's standpoint, is most of them are either SEC or Pac-12 schools. They don't play in either of those conferences. You can only play them maybe in February, and even then you can only pick select teams. So you're right, and Michigan being down hurt them. They didn't play Michigan in the conference, but that's a very – I'm blown away that that's the direction they would go with. I mean, I can't imagine that ever happening in any other sport, Adam. I mean, you've called women's basketball, you call soccer. That would never happen in any of the other sports like that. To have a top five team in a country and a poll in your sport all year long, top 10, to all of a sudden drop 10 spots. They were ranked seventh in the rankings that was released May 6th. And in a week, they win the Big Ten tournament and drop 10 spots, basically. That's just mind-boggling. And it just mind-boggles what the committee's doing sometimes. Just shakes your head.
Yeah, and it really undermines the top 10 release that they started doing this year. Because all that did was call more attention to the fact that, as you said, a team dropped over 10 spots without losing. So I think there's definitely some questions left to be asked about that going forward. But This is what we get, right? And this is what happens sometimes. There's always one or two teams that feel slighted, and it's a matter of what they do about it. But I have noticed this, and this is over the course of the last couple of years. I was thinking about this yesterday when I was looking at the potential draw. There's just so many more good teams now than there used to be. I remember when Florida was first going to College World Series 10 years ago, the Super Region would be against a Cal team. It was clearly, you know, a top 20 team, but a team that maybe wasn't as threatening as one that you'd see today that's in the top 20. If you look right now at the teams that are seeded, you can make cases for almost all of those teams to go to the College World Series and would probably be surprised if they didn't. So I'd say, yeah, a good 13, 14 of those teams feel like they should be hosting Super Regionals, and then you've got random teams below there like Minnesota that have a claim in addition. So I think it's parity. Parity is definitely becoming a bigger, bigger part of college softball, and it makes the decisions for the committee even more challenging.
13 of the 64 teams on the field are from the Southeastern Conference. They got all teams in. It's a record. Also, the SEC will host 8 sites. I was not surprised. I predicted it in my projections they would have all 13 in, and they would have the 8 teams host. I actually nailed that correctly. I know some people were surprised by Kentucky hosting, but I felt they had enough situations that kind of worked in their favor. Your reaction on the SEC as somebody who's been in that league for a long time, 13 teams, I'm assuming you agree with that decision and the SEC hosting 8.
Well, I think it shows the strength of the SEC top to bottom, and that's really what it's all about. It's not just about having a couple of teams that are really good at the top. And that's why I'll tell you what I think is maybe the most interesting regional in some respects is the Tallahassee regional. Because if you look at Florida State, they went undefeated in the ACC, but there's no other team in the ACC with a top 30 RPI. So you could almost use the Minnesota argument compared with Florida State. The difference is, Florida State had the chance to play Florida a couple times. They went to Oregon. They did those things out of conference that you have to do to overcome a weak conference. But the reason I think that Florida State's regional is interesting is because there's Florida State, far and away the best team in the ACC, and they will likely play Georgia, who was last in the SEC this year, which is remarkable, by the way, given all the other teams that finished above them. But Georgia did not even make the SEC tournament, but they are in a regional. What kind of fight will they bring to Florida State, and what can the essentially worst of the SEC do to the best of a league like the ACC, which you can probably put in the same category as the Big Ten? I think that's an interesting storyline to kind of look at how strong the SEC is from the bottom. I also want to see what Ole Miss does. That, to me, is fascinating. They were an unbelievable story to watch throughout the SEC tournament and really easy to root for. I love after it was over when they were talking about just what it meant. Mike Smith said, "I'm going to Disney World and Disneyland." I've always wanted to say that. I mean, just like this aw shucks, and that's real for them. Their program has no history, and they're building it just during this postseason. I'm curious if they can hold up. A 12 seed is very, very surprising for them. I didn't think they'd be seeded. The way that the SEC is sort of looked down upon for the tournament, no one really puts a lot of weight in that tournament. And yet, Ole Miss is given a ton of credit for winning that tournament and flies up the RPI and the rankings. But Florida loses their first game and is not penalized for that at all. So I'm curious, again, going back to the committee, I'm sorry to go tangential here, but I just think this is interesting. The way that they make decisions, and why is the SEC tournament the end-all, be-all to work in favor of an Ole Miss? And then why were teams like Florida not penalized for losing early in that same tournament? These are some of the inconsistencies that I think are really interesting. But getting back around to the central point, the SEC proved this year that they have a lot of strength pretty much everywhere. Everybody got big wins, pretty much save for Georgia. Even Arkansas was winning games. Mississippi State was winning games. The league has shown that the investment they've put into their infrastructure, almost everybody's got a top-of-the-line stadium now. They've been able to attract recruits from all over the country. We're seeing that pay dividends with this release of the NCAA tournament field.
Not only that, but the television, the exposure. And you're part of it in your run at Florida with the SEC Network Plus. You could pretty much watch every SEC team play on your laptop. And I see players watching. That's the channel they go to watch SEC softball. That has to help from an exposure standpoint, from a recruiting standpoint, which is why I think this was a landmark day. This was a landmark deal that, as a result of that SEC Network deal, the SEC Network Plus, and the exposure that softball has gotten through the SEC with their TV package, to me, if I'm the rest of the sport, you better figure out, get some exposure, and stop with the paid subscriptions, because those days are getting obsolete, and you're getting beat now by the SECs, but not only by facilities and money, certainly, but also the exposure that they provide, and that's content. Why the SEC's at where they're at.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. I think the ability to watch games all over the country has been a huge, huge boon for the league. And I think we knew that. And that was part of the idea behind launching the SEC Network, was the exposure it would give not just to the football teams, but to all the teams. Because you have every sport pretty much getting coverage. You have soccer getting coverage. You have softball. You have baseball. You have women's basketball. I mean, it's been across the board. We've seen the impact. But it's also coincided, the SEC Network sort of launched at the same time that softball got to the next level. I mean, softball has become incredibly popular around the country, and you look at the national ratings for it, the TV windows that's getting, primetime, ESPN. I mean, this is serious stuff we're talking about with softball, and ESPN's made a commitment to the sport, and the SEC has made a commitment to both the network and to its teams, and I think all of that has come together now 5 years in to the network, where it's paying off in a big way.
And I also think that the SEC and the administrations have supported the softball programs, where maybe other schools across maybe are still thinking outdated, back to the 80s and 90s.
Baseball.
Where they're either thinking college baseball, you're right, they're putting their money in college baseball, even though, as Adam mentioned, college softball now is crushing college baseball in television ratings.
Yes.
Like, it's not an accident that a lot of college softball is in prime time right now and college baseball is not. That's not an accident. That's because softball is dominating the ratings over baseball. And then I think a lot of administrations are still outdated with that, and they're also outdated because they still think women's basketball is the most popular women's sport. And if you take UConn ton away. That's not accurate at all. And I think that's the other reason. The SEC kind of saw that. They saw the popularity of softball there, Adam, and they're putting money into it, whereas the other schools don't do that, and that's why I think there's a bit of a gap right now.
Yeah, no question. I mean, softball, it's very popular. And listen, I think softball is a great product. I went to, I mean, just to help highlight this, I went to the SEC tournament last week, and since it was one of my last assignments for Florida, I made a little trip out of it and took my dad with me. And we were watching the Alabama A&M game before the Florida game was about to call, and he, it had been a while since he had gone to a game. And he said, he just kept marveling. I think Alabama turned a really good-looking double play, and he said, wow, he said, these guys can really play. And I said, yeah. I think people realize that it's become a really, really attractive sport because it is very, very watchable. It's a quality product that is fun to watch. And I'm not going to go into specifics of why some other sports don't have that, but as far as a women's sport that I think people really like across the board, across all genders, it is softball before all the others. I don't think there's any question about that. And credit to ESPN for recognizing that with pumping up their coverage.
To the point where they've announced they're going to carry all 16 regionals on their family of networks, whether it be ESPN, ESPN2, and ESPNU. They just released the kind of their schedule with the broadcasters, and it looks a lot like March Madness, Adam, where there's going to be softball all day and night, all weekend, which is phenomenal for the sport. It's a far cry from when you and I started, where when Florida was in a regional, you were part of the broadcast for Gatorvision.
Yeah, no, it's changed. It's changed drastically. And again, credit them for expanding the coverage, for recognizing that the demand was there. And I'm happy that people have figured it out. People have gotten wise to it. And these players have become really, really big names locally. I mean, you should see the crowds for Florida. And this also speaks to that, too. This year, interestingly enough, Florida started charging for softball for the first time ever. And I think there were some cynics who felt like, oh, well, now that it's not free, people won't come as much. People came before because it was free. I'm not saying it's super expensive. I mean, it's still $3-5 a ticket. But now there is an actual price you have to pay to get in the gates. And Florida set multiple attendance records this season. And I imagine if it's Florida-Alabama and the Supers, they will break those records on top of that. So I don't think there's any question that people are invested in softball, and places like Florida have recognized that and been the beneficiaries.
There's no doubt about that. We're speaking with Adam Schick, longtime radio voice of the Florida Gators and television voice with the SEC Network Plus. And we mentioned it. You started in 2008. That's when I met you at the Gainesville Regional, which, you know, looking back on it, was a wild regional. Florida was the number one overall seed. I think it was the first time they've been number one overall seed. UCF was a two. We had USF and UCF, and then Georgia Tech, and that large out of the ACC was a four seed, which is kind of crazy to think about now looking back. I get asked this question a lot, so I'm going to ask you this question. What got you involved with the softball and the Florida Broadcasting softball?
It's interesting, is my start with Florida softball was really a product of doing soccer. That was the first sport I ever did at Florida, just by accident. I happened to be at the student radio station as a freshman, and Steve Russell, the sports director, had asked me when I was sitting out in the bullpen, he said, hey, we need someone to go sit in and do a soccer game, or at least fill in for a soccer game. Would you be interested in doing that? And I said, yeah, I mean, I guess so. I thought about it, and so I don't really know anything about soccer, but I guess I'll try it. And then getting the foot in the door there led to softball, which then led to women's basketball and so on and so forth. But when I started softball, I knew nothing about it. And I started the 2008 season. I remember, and this again shows you how far the sport has come, it was a tournament at USF, but it was at a rec field in Clearwater because they didn't have a stadium at that point. Now they have this unbelievable stadium. At the time, we're doing a broadcast from the stands at USF, you know, foul balls crashing into the bleachers and, you know, all that good stuff. And now look at where the sport is today, especially USF. But that was how I got involved. And the first couple years were just a whirlwind learning the sport and being along the ride as Florida went from being an also-ran to being the dominant program in the country. And now, I'm sure you guys saw this, but over the last 10 years, Florida's won more games than any other program. This is the third straight year the Gators have been the number one overall seed, fifth time overall in a decade. I mean, that's pretty incredible when you think about some of the other programs and what they've accomplished. So I've been along for the ride, and it's been a lot of fun. It's been very interesting going through it and just having the highs and the lows, getting to the World Series, losing in regionals. I mean, there's been a little bit of everything, and it's been really, really exciting to be a part of.
You're moving on. You're the voice now of Atlanta United in the MLS. I know you're excited, for you're from Atlanta, so you're excited to be back home and calling a professional franchise in Atlanta with another sport that's growing in the MLS and the interest and popularity there. But as you mentioned, that means also that you're ending your long run as the voice of the Gators softball. Have you reflected, had a chance to reflect on your run there? I mean, you've seen a lot of games, a lot of great players there.
Yeah, I mean, I started thinking about that last week, actually, just the number of players. And I thought about this because we were at the SEC tournament. I was telling someone, I said, you know, I've been here so long that I was calling the game the last time the SEC tournament was in Knoxville, and Megan Bush was a sophomore and hit a grand slam off Kelsey Dunn. And then I realized how many cycles there have been since then of players that have come and gone, entire classes that have graduated. And maybe the most interesting thing about it is just the change in perspective. When I first started, I was a sophomore in college. So the senior class, I mean, they were older, right? I mean, they were people that I literally looked up to and were older than me and more, you know, more mature and more experienced and all of that. And now going through it to the point where I'm the old guy. Like, the players look at me now when I would travel with the team, and I you know, we don't speak the same language anymore. but that doesn't mean I haven't seen some incredible players of all ages and multiple classes. And I'm happy I got to see what Kelly Barnhill got through this year. I wasn't at as many games as I have been in the past, but seeing what she's done coming out of my hometown, by the way, of Marietta, Georgia, and my rival high school, Pope High School, that's been really, really cool, because I thought I'd seen it all. And I thought, when I saw what Stacey Nelson did and I saw Hannah Rogers and Lauren Hager, I didn't think I'd ever see someone as dominant as Kelly Barnhill. But watching her just blow people away with relative ease has been something else. I mean, she has otherworldly stuff that I don't think we've seen in the sport in maybe 15 to 20 years.
I can relate to the language issue with the young players now. I mean, I'm in the same boat. They're all like my niece's age now, so it's like it's a different world than when I was talking to the Allison Kimes and I was growing, starting in the broadcasting there, and Brianna Javier. So you're right. They do look me as the older statesman there a little bit, and it's always, well, I get reminded of that when certain players call me, yes, sir. I'm like, whoa.
Right.
Whoa, hey.
When did we cross that bridge?
Yeah. Let's not go there, Vic. Have you gotten me called sir yet, Vic? Have you been called sir yet?
Thankfully, no.
Okay. Well, that's not it's a weird feeling when that happens to you.
Stay young, Victor. Stay young.
Yeah.
Well, every time I hear Lopez Red, I do stay young.
There you go. You know. Now, I remember when I met you, it was that 08 regional. Now, you were working with Steve Russell at the time. And back then, yeah, you guys did select games. You didn't do every game like now. I mean, that's grown. I mean, Florida is now on the radio in Gainesville and Ocala year-round, every game broadcasted. You've been doing games now on SEC Network Plus with a majority of those home games that are not nationally picked up. So it's really exploded since you started there. But you started off with Steve Russell, and eventually you got to be the quarterback of the broadcast. And I know you worked with Megan Bush, who you mentioned, for a long time. That's probably the one analyst that people will associate with you, but you've worked with other analysts there during that run as well.
Yeah, well, I started with Steve Russell, and it's always funny because the call of the Grand Slam in 2009, the Allie Gardner walk-off against Alabama, which I'll still remember. I think I almost knocked. At the time, the stadium in Oklahoma City was not nearly in the state that it is now. They've done a lot of renovations and put a lot of money into it, but at the time, they had us at tables outside in the stands. And I remember I almost knocked over the table that was in front of us because, it's my first time doing all that. I was very young, and I still got physically excited about things and had trouble reining it in. I just remember the looks. I thought Steve Russell was going to kill me right then and there. And I also just jumped all over the call because I screamed when the ball went over the fence because I wasn't calling it. So I was in my room the other day, and I had my TV on in my living room, and they were playing the Florida softball commercial, which features that call. And every time I hear it, I wince a little bit, but it blows out any speaker that it's playing from, just me as a 20-year-old, just like shrieking uncontrollably. So it takes me back to that place and reminds me how grateful I am that Steve Russell did not decide to end my life on that day. But no, after that, I started working with Megan Bush. And before that, actually, there was a time I did a season with Christina Hilberth, who was a former Gator catcher, and we had a lot of fun. Had an interesting, again, the whole younger brother, older sister type dynamic. We had that for sure. I thought she was going to kill me on multiple occasions. I did some games with Allie Gardner, did some games with Mary Ratliff. They were both really, really interesting, brought a lot of perspective. And then was with Megan Bush. I think it was 4 or 5 years with Megan Bush, and then this year has been with Kelsey Horton. So I've gotten to work with a lot of the bigger names for Florida softball over the last decade, and it's been really cool just getting their different perspective. They all have their own view of the way Tim Walton affected them and his principles and how they might impact certain players over others. So it's been really interesting just to get all those different perspectives over the years.
Do you have a favorite memories or two from your broadcasting career? I would assume when the back-to-back national titles is at the top.
Yeah, that was really, really cool being a part of that. It's the kind of thing that you always hope you get to be a part of, and you're never sure that you're going to, especially in 2009 and 2011 when Florida got to the finals the way that they did, doing it in the Grand Slam in 2009 and then doing it in 2011 on the just demolition of Alabama, bringing it back to that rivalry we could potentially see next week. To get that far and then to be swept and to be really just crushed in the finals by Washington and Arizona State respectively, you start wondering, well, maybe it's just never going to happen. And that's why the runs in 2014 and 2015 were so special. Especially 2014, I think, was really the one that stands out, not just because it was the first, but what most people don't remember and wouldn't know about that year, and this is why when you win, you don't have to answer as many questions about your past. Mid-season, that point, Florida went on a 6-game losing streak, got run ruled by Kentucky on the road. This is before Kentucky was what they are today. And Hannah Rogers was getting absolutely lit up. And she was the point where she couldn't get people out. She was giving up home runs to slappers up in Lexington. I'm not exaggerating. They were literally slappers for Kentucky that were launching home runs. So to go from that point in mid-March, early April, to being the Hannah Rogers that led Florida through an undefeated run in Oklahoma City, I mean, that was next level stuff, and it was so surprising because of what took place up until that point. And that's what makes it great. That's why when you asked the questions earlier about Florida's offense and how these matchups play out, the answer is you just don't know, because you never are really sure how a team is going to respond in postseason situations, which players will step up and become that just will not be denied, and which ones maybe don't have that extra bit that gets you over the top when you're in a one-and-done situation. That's what makes 2014 really, really special for me. And as far as overall memory, I would say that. And going back to maybe one day that was the best, because I just referenced this to someone else recently. 2011, Sunday of 2011 in the World Series semifinals, when Florida had to come out of the loser's bracket and beat Alabama twice and ended up run-ruling Alabama, I want to say it was 16-3. It was something ridiculous, but it was laughable the way that Florida was launching home runs out of there. Everybody was hitting home runs like you were playing a preseason scrimmage, and that was against Alabama and Kelsey Dunn. So that was probably the most fun I've ever had calling a game, because I think there were about 10 or 11 See You Later Gators in just that one afternoon.
That's a lot of great memories. I'm a little disappointed you didn't mention all the even years we got to hang out during regionals when UCF got placed there every even year. That was the joke. Hey, I'll see you in even years. 2008, 2010, 2012, 2014, 2016.
Those were next on the list.
I was just about to mention that. That's second on the list there.
Yeah, I'm sure.
It's next on the list.
I'm sure. I know you enjoyed a lot of players covering. Any that stands out, maybe not even just because they're an amazing player, but maybe just interviewing them. Like, what players jumps out at you when you look back with the interviews and watching them and covering them?
Gosh, it's interesting just because I think my perspective has changed based on my age. You know, because when I was younger, when I was closer in age to the players, I had a different relationship with them than I have today, which we sort of touched on that. But you know, one player I always loved watching and covering was Lauren Hager, just because there's something about unbridled passion that just gets you really, really excited to call a game and be a part of it. And I sort of felt that when I was watching Ole Miss last week and what Caitlin Lee was able to do. I mean, she was just so fired up. You couldn't help but feel part, you know, not, I don't want to say part of that. I wasn't part of Ole Miss's run, but to just get lost in that energy and to just appreciate what is so great about the game, which is that passion, which you know comes from a place of just pure competitiveness and joy, because that's what this is about at the end of the day. You're not getting paid to play at this level. It's about the joy of winning and competition. And Lauren Hager, really, I saw that in her to such an extent that really stuck with me. And to see the way that she put Florida on her back a couple of years ago on her way to National Player of the Year and a national championship, I mean, that was the kind of thing that you just never see. When she's up for an ESPY against LeBron, I mean, that finding another softball player that will ever get that kind of accolade, and I would be first in line to see who that is.
I remember I told you right after that national championship, her last national championship, she was actually on a local Orlando morning radio show as she was on. And that was because Florida, and you know, that Michigan-Florida Women's College World Series was the most watched television program in Central Florida. And I think that stunned a lot of people, and it tells you about the growth of the sport and the growth of the popularity of Florida softball. And you've been a big part of that because you've lended your voice to that program for a long time since 2008. You'll be always the guy that called those two national championships. And I think Gator fans that have tuned in over the years will certainly appreciate that and miss you. Although we hope that you know, you still get to call some softball down the road, whether it be with Florida in the SEC or elsewhere.
Yeah, no, and listen, I'm really grateful to all of the fans and the people who've reached out, and there's so many of them, whether it's people on Twitter, people at the games, and it really touched me a couple weeks ago, because I've been back and forth throughout the season, going up to Atlanta, doing Atlanta United games, and coming back to Gainesville, and I was calling a game a few weeks ago, and I remember some of the season ticket holders have those prime seats, but I don't play it. They leaned up, they said, well, they said, you know, is Adam gone? Is Adam coming back? And then I stood up. They didn't see me there. I stood up and they saw me. They got so excited. They started cheering. And that, you know, that meant a lot to me. I mean, the relationships I built with the people, not just at work here, but the people who come to the games, the members of the Gator Diamond Club, who is the booster club for the team. They're so passionate about the Gators. They've been so good to me. A couple of them, really, really good people. Bill and Mary actually gave me a congratulations card when they found out I got the new job. So it's just people that, you know, in a small community like this, you can get to know those people on a first name basis, on a personal basis. And I really, really treasure the time I've gotten to spend with those people, speaking at their club and being able to bring them really exciting games over the years and a lot of wins for Florida during my time.
A longtime voice of the Florida Gators since 2008. Adam, I don't know what I'm going to do next year when UCF gets put in the Gainesville Regional in an even year. It's going to be very odd. I may not just show up. I might not just show up. Just out
you
of
better
protest.
Show up.
Well, maybe. Maybe you and I can work something out. Maybe we'll hang out on even years for an Atlanta, you know, United Orlando City soccer game or something. We got to come up with something.
Well, yeah, listen, there's going to be the Atlanta United Orlando City rivalry. It's already a thing. There hasn't been a game between them
really?
Yet. It's already this back and forth of both cities are claiming to be the soccer capital of the South. So that'll get really interesting. We can make that a new thing, because that's going to happen at least twice a year, and in this case, three times this year between July and September.
Deal. We got a deal, Vic. We got it all.
Got it on wax.
Even years. That's got to be even years, though. That's the only thing we could do. And you know, we'll still probably sprinkle in some softball talk. Adam, take it easy, my friend. Always enjoyed talking to you. And again, always a pleasure seeing you all these years and listening. Not only listening to you, but obviously seeing you every time we see you at the regionals. And heck, I've seen you in women's soccer games for that matter. So I'm excited for you. I'm excited for your adventure at Atlanta United. I know that's just the beginning for you. So don't forget us, you know, when you become big time in Atlanta.
No, thank you. I appreciate it. Listen, I appreciate what you guys do for softball, you know, for having this podcast and being able to spread this talk. You know, in the old days, you wouldn't have an outlet to hear people outraged that Minnesota didn't get a national seed. So what you guys have done as part of building the sport and the interest is important as well. And that's led to more and more eyeballs and more listeners and all that. So credit to you guys for what you've done for softball in the state of Florida, and I certainly look forward to talking to you in the future.
Appreciate that very much, Adam, and I feel like it's only appropriate and in your honor that we'll leave this saying, we'll see you later, Gator.
Thank you guys very much. I appreciate it.
Adam Schick joining us there. And, Vic, that was fun. And for those that maybe didn't catch that little liner about see you later, Gator, that was
that's his home run call.
Correct.
See you later, Gator. That's his home run call.
Which, you know, if you're a Gator fan, you've enjoyed it a lot. He's going to be doing a lot of good stuff there. There's no question about it. He's super talented. I just hope that we could still hear him do softball.
Yeah.
That's my only hope.
Yeah.
You got to do what you got to do.
That's right. And, hey, he gave me some critiques being a lowly Division II broadcaster myself. So he was very supportive of that. And that's what you kind of need.
And
in
he will
industry.
Be missed there. Yeah. I mean, I've noticed this too in my situation. Every time I miss games, people are like, where were you? We're like, what's going on? And I think it's going to be the same in Florida there. That'll be a rough adjustment because they've gotten to know Adam. And Adam used to do a radio show there in Gainesville, Ocala, and used to talk a lot of softball.
It's the ending of one chapter.
It's going to be tough for the next guy that or person that's got to replace. So that will be big shoes to fill.
Yeah.
And not to
mention the other roles Adam does.
It's going to be interesting. Does, women's basketball voice, soccer voice with Matthew Stubbington. He's been hosting the Gator podcast.
Gator Tales.
So who knows? I mean, it was a lot of hats and became familiar voice in that market. And for that sport, he's done a lot. And I hope that the Florida fans, and I think they do, and the program there appreciated what he has done there.
So. Yes.
Vic, one last time, where can they tell
follow us? Follow us on In the Circle SB on Twitter and Facebook. Subscribe and follow our podcast on Podomatic as well as Apple Podcasts. Send us an email at InTheCircleSB@gmail.com. And, of course, we will have our blog, InTheCircleBlog.wordpress.com.
All right, thanks again to Adam Schick for joining us. For Victor Anderson, I'm Eric Lopez. This has been In the Circle.